I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We're about to have another one of our Urbanite radio conversations. They came out of an article in this month's Urbanite called The Labyrinth, written by Michael Corbin, who spent time working in juvenile institutions. This is called The Labyrinth, a trip to the state's juvenile system, exposes our divided and contradictory thinking about young criminals and suggests a way out. And the question we explore today is, should any juvenile be charged as an adult in our system? What happens to juveniles who are charged in our adult system? We've done many shows like this before. This is our continuing conversation about that. We are joined by Laura Furr in our studios, in Hamden at Clean Cuts Music and Sound. Laura Furr is Senior Director of Youth Justice Initiatives at Community Law in Action. Good to have you back in our studios once again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Gary McElhenney is with us once again. He's now the lead negotiator at Schlockman, Belsky, and Wiener, a law firm in town that represents police officers. He's former president of the Baltimore Fraternal Order of Police and former chief of the Maryland Transit Authority of Police.
Great to be back, Mark.
Good to hear you, Gary. It's been a while.
Nice to see you.
And Michael Williams is back with us. He was here with us just about a week ago or so. He's a playwright, youth advocate, spent a lot of his life in the state prison system, and spent that early part of his life as a juvenile in an adult system. And Michael Williams, good to see you again, man. Welcome back to the studios.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So let's talk about this. I mean, this is an issue that is really becoming, I think, for reasons, in some ways, financial reasons, but others, coming to the fore again. Last year, Connecticut stopped treating all 16-year-old offenders as adults. Next year, this coming year, 17-year-olds will no longer be tried as adults, no matter what the crime is in Connecticut. Illinois just recently transferred certain low-level offenders younger than 18 back into the juvenile system, changing its law. And Los Angeles has a bill that will raise the age of adulthood matters of crime, and their counterparts in Wisconsin, North Carolina intend to do the same. And New York may be the only state where adulthood begins at 16 in that region. And so it raises a lot of issues. So the question is, we'll go down the aisle here for a moment, and so to speak. Starting with Laura Furr, should any juvenile, for any reason, do you think, ever be charged as an adult?
Well, you know, of course, we have the Just Kids Partnership, which put out the Just Kids Report last year, and we studied what's happening in Maryland now. And, of course, what happens in Maryland now is we have the automatic prosecution of youth as adults for certain crimes based on their age. What we're saying is that no youth should automatically be charged as an adult. What we want to have is have an opportunity for a judge to take an informed and rational look at the case and at the youth before they determine that that child should be charged as an adult. You know, we're not saying, I can't say, you know, this kid should be and this kid should not be. But I think that judges need to be taking a look at the situation and have really all the information they can to make those decisions.
Gary McElhenney.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that in cases of violent crimes, certain violent crimes, that set an arbitrary age of whether it's 15, 16, 17, and not looking at the offense itself and government's overriding responsibility to protect its citizens, which should be the first priority, that there are clearly cases where juveniles should be automatically charged as adults. There is a process in the state of Maryland. It's a waiver hearing, and judges enter into those hearings all the time to make a decision whether the case should stay there or not. But in crimes of violence, I really don't care what the age is. If it's appropriate on certain crimes to charge someone as an adult, they should be charged as an adult because they committed an adult crime. Obviously, in some cases, it's not appropriate to try someone based on a lot of circumstances, their mental capability, the type of crime they committed. But for violent crimes, we have offenders in this city, whether they're 13 or 14 years old, 15 years old, committed some of the most heinous crimes, and I think it's appropriate that they be charged as an adult.
Michael Williams, been there and back. What do you think?
Yes, sir. I came, I came also with the belief that certain crimes should automatically qualify a young offender to be tried as an adult. For an example, murder. However, I concur with Laura's view that, you know, if a crime for murder is committed, I still think that, you know, that a hearing should be determined what other type of factors that are, you know, existing in that young man's or young woman's life You know, are there mental health issues? You know, is the person really responsible? You know, and as Ms. McClenney said about the waiver hearing, you know, as long as that, you know, fairness is meted out, you know, before the adult, I mean, before the delinquent is actually charged as an adult, you know, having a hearing to determine whatever type of mitigating circumstances, you know, are going on, you know, before that determination is made. But generally, I believe that certain crimes does qualify young offenders to be treated as adults, and particularly the sentence that's meted out, and not necessarily the institution that they're put in.
So let me push all three of you then, because you have different spectrums in this, and I'll take the position here for a moment that nobody should be tried as an adult in our institutions, no matter what the crime. The question is, let me ask the three of you, why should somebody be tried? Let's say a kid commits a crime of, let's take two of the most horrendous crimes you can take, for me anyway.
Okay.
Rape.
Mm-hmm.
And murder, and or aggravated assault that really hurts another human being in a very serious way. Those are three crimes I think that are pretty horrendous. And I will say this in terms of being someone who spent a good portion of his life, a good 15 years of his life, working in and out of prisons and working with young people and families, with young people who have been in trouble with the law, and having met some young people and adults who I think are some of the worst characters I've met in my existence, who are pretty vicious young human beings. May be able to change, but they're pretty vicious young human beings. But if they are separated from society and put in institutions with juveniles or in a separate institution for juveniles, why should any child, I'll use the word child, be charged as an adult if, in fact, they're going to be dealt with and separated from us for the crime they committed? Ray? Gary, I mean?
Yeah. You know, I think the first responsibility of our criminal justice system is to protect the rest of us, the law-abiding citizens out there. And the interest of the offender, whether they're a juvenile or adult, is secondary to that responsibility to protect us. And if charging someone as an adult and putting them in the adult system because they committed what some people like to call an adult crime, then they need to be incarcerated with other adults in some cases and protect in order to protect the rest of us at their expense, maybe, because the first responsibility is to protect us.
But see, from my view, the issue is not where we send the kids, but what is keeping the community safer? And the public's being lied to whenever somebody says that locking these kids up in adult jails is making the community safer, because there's evidence, report after report, the CDC report in 2007, all of the reports that we highlight in our report, in the Just Kids report, show that juveniles who are treated in the juvenile system commit fewer future crimes and less serious future crimes than kids who are warehoused in adult jails. So if we're really talking about what's making our community safer, we have to be talking about what's also impacting that juvenile. I mean, you can't separate the two. So when we're talking really, do we want to make our community safer, we have to be, the answer, according to the evidence, is these kids are going into the juvenile system and being treated, if that's what our goal is.
Well, I think the thing we have to recognize about the juvenile system is they're going to get out, and they're going to get out in relatively short order.
Right.
In the juvenile system, whereas the adult system, the incarceration can be much longer, and the ability to punish the criminal is there in the adult system. In the juvenile system, I mean, we had that case down in Prince George's County where the counselor was, you know, raped and murdered at a juvenile facility.
Right.
For someone that very,
he was 13. The kid was 13, right?
Kid was 13.
He committed the crime, right?
Committed a rape and murder of an employee at a center. There was no way to protect her. The juvenile system, while it's not the country club, some people think it is.
Club.
It's not a country club. Trust me. In the way they house, particularly in the housing sections of those facilities, some of these folks need to be in adult facilities. And they need to be there for a long time.
Well, isn't it the fact, though? Before we turn to Mike here, Williams, isn't it the fact that? Maybe it's not, that if you're 13 or 14 years old and you've committed a violent rape or murder, a violent crime, that you serve your time in juvenile institution and then you get transferred to an adult institution.
Not in this state.
Not in the Maryland.
We do not have blended sentencing here. But I do want to point out that the research that we did showed that only, I forget whether it was 7 or 12% of the kids that we looked at actually served any time in adult prison. The rest of those kids, of the 130 cases that we looked at, either went back to the juvenile system, and this is of kids who are automatically charged, went back to the juvenile system, had their cases dismissed, so they're going out on the street with nothing, or received sentences of time served and probation. So when you're saying, you know, the adult system houses these kids much longer, that's not true. It's only in very, very rare cases, and the longest sentence that we saw of actual time to be served was 12 years. So that kid's coming out, you know, at the age of 30 at the most. So we're really not seeing these long-term sentences that are supposedly going to protect the community because this kid's going to be locked away. We're seeing this kid come home but without any extra treatment and having been subjected to all of the abuses and the problems that come from being in adult prisons and jails.
And I think your numbers, you know, your numbers are reflective of the entire criminal justice system, most likely, if you just looked at them in terms of juveniles and in whether they were incarcerated for a period of time, whether their cases were dismissed.
This was juvenile cases charged as adults in Baltimore City.
And if you compare that to the regular adult cases in the city, you'll probably find similar results, I would suspect. No, that's one of the problems. Very few people are doing the time they deserve to be doing in Baltimore City's criminal justice system. It's just not happening.
Mike?
Well, I kind of concur with Gary, what he said in reference to the punishment. The reason why I take that position, such as going back to the examples of murder and rape, because if you're charged as an adult, you know, you're facing a life sentence. Over for murder, you know, possibly for rape too. I mean, the sentence that's meted out in adult criminal court is definitely a great difference from what would be meted out in the juvenile court for the same crime. So that's my take on certain crimes, you know, of violence, such as murder and rape. But as it relates to other crimes, then I think that there should be, you know, a halt in just, for instance, you know, possession of handgun or possession of drugs. You know, I think that the young offender should be really given an opportunity, you know, to change his or her course of action through the juvenile system.
So let me, Laura, we're going to jump in. I have some real specific questions. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to take it back to not just this hypothetical world of, you know, just kids being charged with murder and rape going through this system. We have kids who are being charged with low-level sex offenses. We had one kid who was 16. He was a big, big guy. He was charged with a third-degree sex offense, and he was charged automatically as an adult. He had the mental capacity of an 8-year-old, but he was housed in solitary confinement at the Baltimore City Detention Center for months before they finally got him in front of a judge who said, no, you need to be in the juvenile system. But we're seeing 5 months of incarceration in an adult jail for that kid. So we're not just talking something where a judge has taken a look at the story and said, you are not salvageable. We need to put you in the adult system where you're going to be punished, and that's all we care about. We're not talking about that. We're talking about every single kid who falls under this really long 33-crime list of things that can put you in the adult system automatically without any review.
So let's wrestle with this on a couple levels here. For the three of you, what is it, Laura Furr, that should put a child who has committed a crime in an adult, through the adult judicial system and an adult prison?
I don't think I would ever be able to make that sort of, I mean, you know, a judge needs to take a look at the whole.
What does that mean?
Circumstances.
I mean, right now we have a situation where some kids are immediately put in an adult system.
Correct.
Through the adult system. Mm-hmm. So that's what you think is a mistake.
Correct.
How should it change? And I'm curious how it should not change. But how should it change from your perspective?
Right. I think that no kid should automatically go in. I think that they should be automatic in the juvenile system, and then a judge should take a look. I can't sit here and say, like, well, if it was this crime and this juvenile history and this age and, you know, all of that stuff, this family background, that says this kid should go, because I think there's just too many factors. But that's why I think a judge needs to take a look at it, because there is too much to consider. You really need to consider the totality of that circumstances before you say that kid needs to go in.
I think it's types of crimes. I agree with Laura in that drug offenses and some of these other crimes where there's not a direct victim of violence should be automatically charged as an adult. To answer your question directly, Mark, it's crimes of violence. If there's a victim and there's a horrendous crime committed against that person, and I'll go back to the murder and the rape,
yeah,
it's an automatic charge and put into the adult system. You know, this arbitrary age, I mean, people that have been on the street, I don't care if you're 16 or you're 15, if you're 6'4" and you're living on the street and living in that world, and you decide you're going to use a gun and kill somebody or you're going to rape someone, then you deserve the adult punishment and to be in the adult system from day one. Now, there's a process in that system that allows a judge to bring you back into the juvenile system in Maryland, and that process will play itself out. But from day one, central booking.
So what happens to the two things? I mean, what I was thinking about was we had a woman on this show once whose name I'm blanking, will come back to me in a minute, whose son was a child, 16, mm-hmm, in an adult system for 2 years.
Lisa.
I know she was here today because she would round this panel interestingly because of the different perspectives, mm-hmm, here. And her son was found, was released, mm-hmm, not charged, after those 2 years, in an adult system.
After
2 years. And so he came back. He was no longer the same human being.
Mm-hmm.
He was traumatized inside that prison.
Right.
What'd she described him as a monster.
As a monster who turned, went in as a kid, came back as a monster. I mean, is that justified?
Not knowing the circumstances, I don't think.
I know.
But someone to be in a system for 2 years and not be charged says something about the system.
It does. Doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It says something about the system.
We have another kid who was in for 2 years, and he was charged with murder, in for 2 years, and then the state's attorney steaded it, so he was never prosecuted, mm-hmm, and they let him out, and he's free, and he's got no services, no nothing being provided to him.
And we don't know to this day whether that kid committed a murder, didn't commit a murder. He was just in for 2 years. Now he's back in the street.
Right. Now he's got a stet. And,
right. There's nothing. Yeah, and there's
so,
nothing happening.
I mean, that system is insane.
Yeah.
I would agree. You can't defend a system that keeps people in jail for years without trial or without the case being adjudicated. It's
Mike?
Well, that's like Laura spoke on the 33 crimes. I remember reading some time ago about the various crimes that would qualify you, but my position is primarily, with Gary's position is in that, number one, there should be qualifying crimes that would make you eligible for being waived as an adult. And those two crimes, on my list is murder and rape. And as Gary was saying, it could be first degree assault, crimes where, there's a victim involved, that would require, for the sentence to be meted out the same way, if a 30-year-old committed it. And I also, think that there should be, a process in place in which it is, like Gary was saying, about the waiver hearing process. Even though that there's a qualifying crime that makes you eligible to be waived as an adult, it's still a judge has to intervene to, I guess, sustain that waiver.
And
she's saying not all the time, but that's an issue of the system. See, the issues of the system and the issues of what the crime should be are two different things, because the system, the juvenile system, may be, failing in one aspect, but I don't think that should erode what the punishment of an offender should be.
Laura?
Well, 2 points just to sort of put some things out there that we discovered through the report is that there is this what we call reverse waiver process where, mm-hmm, the kids who's charged automatically as an adult can file a petition to go up in front of the judge to have their case reviewed and see whether they should be in juvenile. The first thing we found that was a lot of the kids were not ever having that hearing for various reasons. The attorney never files it, whatever's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The kid pleads guilty right away because they, mm-hmm, know they're going to go home because the plea deal that the state offers is, probation. So that's one of the problems with that process, is that it's not happening on a fair basis for all the kids. The other problem is that it takes 5 months of incarceration in the adult jail before that happens, where they're at risk. They're significantly more at risk to commit suicide than if they were in a juvenile facility, and much more at risk to be physically and sexually abused than if they were in a juvenile facility.
I agree.
So we've got that problem. But then also, you know, I mean, when we start talking about what crimes qualify and what doesn't, you mentioned first-degree assault. There's that difference, that line between first-degree assault and second-degree assault. What we see is a huge number of kids being charged with even attempted murder and first-degree assault, but being found guilty of second-degree assault, or being transferred back down and getting charged with second-degree assault, which would have kept them in the juvenile system to begin with. And so when you start talking about that, you get into really serious discretionary issues with the state's attorney, with the police. And then you start to worry, you know, this isn't a judge taking into account all the circumstances. This is just a state's attorney or the police who may or may not have an incentive to overcharge, kicking that up. And then you've got a kid up in the adult system, and we're talking about, again, 2 years before adult trial.
And that kid initially probably shouldn't have been there, what you're saying,
exactly.
In the first place, right?
Exactly.
So the system is overlogged with all of these cases stacked up on, you know, on case by case. And it goes back to, you know, my belief is that that's a deficiency in the system, or the process of the system. Things are in place, you know, to prevent those things from happening. Now, whether or not the officials are following through with that is a whole nother story.
I mean, you have a couple more steps before you get that 2 year mark. I mean, there's going to be a court commissioner reviewing the probable cause, whether that person should even be held. There's going to be a bail review hearing. There's going to be a bail hearing within the first 24 hours before a judge. There's going to be a bail review hearing at some point that attorneys can raise all of these issues of whether it's appropriate to have this person incarcerated to trial. And then you have the checks and balances between the police department and the state's attorney. I can tell you in Baltimore City right now, they're not charging anybody with say, for example, murder sexual assaults without consulting the state's attorney's office first.
That true? From your
well, we've definitely seen, we saw one case where a kid was involved in a group fight, wasn't singled out as having been particularly violent, that particular youth. Police charged that kid with a second degree assault, which would have kept him in juvenile, but the state's attorney bumped it up to first degree assault, which put him in the adult system.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen police go to a scene and without evidence of any gun being present, charging a kid with attempted murder based on, you know, the victim
saying,
he shot me. We had one kid who, he was defending his girlfriend and the house that they were staying in from an ex-boyfriend.
Oh, I remember this case. Yeah.
And he hit the guy over the head with a bottle,
right,
in the fight,
right,
in the altercation. And the guy, when the police showed up, said, he shot me. There's no gun, there's no bullet hole, there's no nothing, but the guy has a graze on his head.
Mm-hmm.
They charged him with attempted first-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
But he ended up being found guilty of second-degree assault because there was absolutely no evidence of a gun being anywhere near the building.
So let me ask the three of this question. Let's see if you all agree on this or not agree on this. Do we have too many people in our prisons, period, right now, do you think?
Gary, yes.
Do you think?
Yes.
You think we do?
Yes.
Okay. Former cop, former head of...
Too many.
You're saying yes?
Yes.
Does anybody disagree that we have too many people in prison?
You know I'm going to say that.
So if we agree with this, former head of the police, former head of the police union, defense attorney.
Ah, I'm not a defense attorney.
Well, not a defense attorney, but somebody who works with people who are involved in the criminal justice system.
Yes.
From that perspective. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to make you a defense attorney. And somebody who has done time,
yes, sir,
in that prison, mm-hmm, as a kid and as an adult,
mm-hmm,
and now trying to keep people out.
Yeah.
Right? So then what do we do? Where does this go? I mean, what do we do to create a system where kids are not automatically charged and put in adult systems, where we have a system that works? It's got to work. I mean,
I'm agreeing with you that we have too many people in the system.
Yeah.
We're probably disagreeing on what type of people need to be in that system.
We might.
So,
we might, Gary.
You know, if long-term incarceration. First, people that need to be in jail are the violent criminals. Okay, petty drug offenders don't need to be doing time. We need to have another system to address those issues, whether it's juveniles or adults. We don't need to be filling up our prisons. We need the space. And there's a lot of people that deserve to be in jail for a lot longer. We don't have truth in sentencing in this state. I mean, you know, you hear on TV that somebody got 30 years for a murder. Everybody says, great, that person's going to be in there until they're an adult. Well, 30 years in the state of Maryland can mean as little as 10. Okay? 10 if you're sentenced to 30. So with good time, am I wrong?
He's absolutely correct.
Okay, so
especially if he's a first-time offender.
We're not keeping our violent criminals in jail, and we're filling it full of people that really need to be there.
But even when people are in jail, as people will hear Chuck Brown talk about in this next segment coming up, who has become one of our great performers in R&B, founded the world of go-go, did his time at Lorton before he went out. And he said, and you'll hear him say that, when I was at Lorton, this was in the late 50s, early 60s, it was a place where you could actually be reformed and come out and go to college, learn music, as I did, he'll say, and come out as a different human being. And if you want to, you can make a change. Mm. We don't do that anymore.
No.
Right.
We lock people up. We put them in prison. There are no programs for people to come out. Guys can't go to college. They maybe can finish high school. They can't go to college. They can't relearn a trade. They can't learn any other way. There's no drug rehab going on. We warehouse people.
But, Mark, I got a guy sitting right next to me. It's done it. It's proof.
But how many years did it take you to do that?
How many incarcerations? Three major. This was my last major incarceration. But, you know, there are programs to dispel the myth. You know, I guess to try to protect, you know, the Maryland Division of Correction. There are programs that's offered. There may not be as much programs offered. There's drug treatment that's offered. There's alternative to violence.
But limited.
Limited. Yes. Very limited. Very limited.
Now the Department of Labor and Licensing and Regulations has taken over the education provided in the jails. Mm-hmm. They've cut the college.
And what is that?
The college is definitely cut.
Yeah, I know who they are. They're the guys that inspect the elevators.
Yeah, they've taken over education in the jails. Isn't that nice?
Wow.
So they've cut the college education options, and they're cutting the GED options now.
Wow.
And that was there 2 years ago is going
to
be gone.
So not to go too far afield here, but I only raise that to say,
yeah.
I mean, it's really screwed up.
It's worse.
What happens here. We have too many people. We have more people in jail in this country than any per capita than any other country on planet Earth. And are we any safer?
And
we're safer from those individuals that deserve to be there.
But not as soon as they come home. And when we're talking, when we're talking about warehousing these people, it's not equal. So warehousing 40-year-old and warehousing a 14-year-old is not the same thing for us.
I totally agree.
So what happens to what happened to you when you were a kid in an adult prison?
I mean, you learn more. You get influenced more by.
You were how old when you went in?
My first time I was 13.
13.
But I wasn't waved on as an adult until I was 15. And, you know, that's when I really first entered the adult system. So, I mean, it's a pattern. You know, it's a pattern. And you just, you know, it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And now, you know, as Gary was saying, you know, it's really just, it's a system that's constantly set up over and over and over again, and it becomes a warehouse. So really, you know, the reform has to be taken by the individual.
So in some ways, I'll throw this out, and Carrie McAleen, I'll let you go first and go to Laura and go back to Mike. I mean, to me, when I look at the system, and I've been covering the system for 18 years on the air, I worked in the system inside the prisons with young guys and girls who were popped. Instead of going to jail, they came to us for these intense programs for 2 years. And we had a powerfully low recidivism rate in that program in the early 70s, mm-hmm. In pretrial intervention, other things I worked in. And it's something that is really amiss here. You've got young people in prison, I think, who should be in adult prisons. You talk to a lot of adult inmates, and they don't want those guys in there because they're worse than the guys who were in there, some of them.
from a cop on the street perspective, give me a seasoned adult that's been through the system. I'll deal with him anytime more than I'll deal with
a
15 or 16-year-old, right?
Yeah,
particularly with a gun.
They messed the system up. That's what the older guys are saying, that, you know, the younger ones have came in and messed the system up because the things we fought for, they just giving them up.
So, what needs, from your perspective, lay something on the table here in the 5 or 7 minutes we've got left to kind of wrestle with about what you think it should look like. And I'm curious to see what Gary thinks it should look like and what Michael thinks it should look like.
Well, the program you just described sounds great. We should just do that. Well, so, no, but I think first thing I think is that we need to have better opportunities in the city that are provided for the youth before they ever get in trouble with the system. While they're in school, while they're not in school, when we catch them, you know, in the summer, when we catch them at the rec centers, we need to be providing opportunities then, jobs, paid opportunities, employment, training, all of this stuff that's going to keep them out of the system in the first place. Because once you get in the system, you're right. I mean, it's just you. It's so easy to stay once you're in, you know, and it's very hard to get out once you're in. So I think that we need to be doing that. And once a kid does get in at the first opportunity, we need to be taking appropriate steps to help that kid and the family, which is also a key for a lot of these kids, is that they're not just doing this in a vacuum. They're doing these things surrounded by a community and a family that may be increasing the opportunity that they're going to do this, increasing the need to do this, increasing the excuses and the opportunities to do this. So that, I think, really has got to be our first step, is fix all of that so that these kids are never getting into that. And then, you know, when we do have a kid that really needs some really intensive help, we give them really intensive help. We don't just lock them into a cell by themselves and throw away the key for however many years we decide arbitrarily they need to be locked away.
See, McElhinney, I've known you for a long time. I can call you that because I've known you for many years, right? You bleed police blue.
Okay. Thanks.
No, you do.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, from that perspective, talk about what has to happen. I mean, it's often at odds with the world of trying people who try to reform the system. When I was a gang worker 40 years ago, looking like in the early 1970s, looking like somebody popped out of Serpico.
Right.
I had my confrontation with the police on the street working with kids, but and we have very different perspectives. So,
Well, I'm going to surprise you right now.
No, you're not.
The first few things that Laura talked about. I mean, yeah, we need better opportunities for these kids before they even get to us, before a police officer on a corner is dealing with them. We need those opportunities. And when they have a hiccup, when they mess up, because usually it's not from going from,
you know, 0 to 60.
0 to 60 in 2 seconds here. Then we need to be able to address. We have to have a system that addresses that problem more effectively. I mean, listen, in Baltimore City, what's the first thing we cut when there's budget problems? Rec centers.
Rec centers. Right.
Right. After school care.
Right. Jobs.
Jobs. Okay, so it's really not a priority, okay? Everybody would rather just lock people up and put them away and not have to deal with them. So we need to deal with these kids so they don't get to the point where they're committing these serious adult crimes. But once they do, I think society, I think the city owes it to the rest of us who are out walking the streets, okay, that these violent individuals be incarcerated. That doesn't mean when they're in the system, they don't get the help they need. Okay, they don't get the drug treatment. They don't get the job training. They need to get that when they're in the system because you're right, Laura. They're coming back. Okay, and we want them to come back. But, you know, I don't see a difference between a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old that commits murder. I really don't. I don't see a difference sometimes between a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old that commits murder. You know, you have a birthday one day, and all of a sudden you're subjected to the adult system. Okay, it should be based on the type of crime you commit. That doesn't say we throw them in jail and throw away the key. We still need to understand that these people are coming back on the street, and we need to be able, they're coming back. In most cases, in vast 99% of the cases, they're coming back. We need to be able to address that issue. But we cannot ignore that some people just need to be locked up.
So, Michael Williams, the last time we spoke, in some ways, I most probably disagreed about this. I'm curious to see what you think. Because when you were a 13-year-old knucklehead, mm-hmm. right? And you were.
Yes,
right?
I was. Yes, I was.
And, you know, and a lot of us were 13-year-old knuckleheads at one
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely.
Right? Did you say to me you thought that you couldn't have been stopped at 13?
Yes. Looking back in hindsight and the way that I was thinking, you know, my tunnel vision, and I say that, you know, based on moms, don't do this. Based on pops, don't do this. Based on my aunt, my uncles, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. So, you know, being told right from wrong was there. And then I didn't grow up, you know, really. We had our struggles, but, you know, I grew up in the Emerson Village section of Baltimore. So that was like middle class at that time, the early 70s. I chose the streets. You know, I was attracted to those things. So like Laura was talking about the influences, you know, that's out there. I believe, like Laura believes and Gary believes, I believe in prevention, number one. That's the first thing I believe in, is prevention. How do we set up a system of prevention before they even get locked up, before they even pick the drug package up, before they even prick the gun up, you know? And you, like Laura was saying, one of the things that has to be involved is that the parents and the community has to get more involved.
Now, Laura, let me turn back to you as we conclude this conversation. So, I mean, I am one who believes kids can be turned around.
Absolutely.
And I do believe, I am one of those who believe you would take putting too many young people in jail, people in jail for too many nonviolent crimes. It's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So talk about what he said and where you think we need to go.
Right.
What do we have to do here?
And frequently the kids will turn around on their own if you give them enough time, because their brain develops, their ability to make decisions, not just based on the immediate gratification, which is what Michael and I were talking about, that about the immediate gratification of what he was dealing with when he was younger and making decisions right then based on what he was seeing. And a lot of times the kids will sort themselves out through just simply growing up without any other interventions. But when we're talking about providing those supports around, you know, around the kids, I wouldn't say, you know, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that if you give a kid a mentor and you give a kid a job, that that's going to solve the issue for every single kid that's out there in Baltimore right now. But I think that we're going to solve the problem for a lot of them. And I think that also a lot of these kids just need to see a different way. Because, again, it's what's going to attract me and what's going to be given me the immediate gratification. What's going to give me the best feeling right now? Because that's how kids' brains work. And we all know that. I mean, we all made stupid decisions when we were kids because we said, oh, well, that's going to be fun right now. And whether, you know, 10 years down the line, I'm going to be in trouble because I got a DUI at 16. You know, which they're waving kids up for on the Eastern Shore, by the way.
Right.
DUIs. So, you know,
waving kids up for DUIs is insane.
Yeah. It is.
Right. We waved an 8-year-old last year in the state.
Yeah. I mean, we're running out. We're going to come back to this. I'm going to bring a fourth person to this discussion kind of next time we do, because I think that we have to begin somehow to have a community discussion that makes some sense out of. We're going to have to make room for two with Laura's case. Somebody's coming to this world soon. But to make sense, because it is insane. I do believe that as crazy as you were as 13, I think that the work that we did back in the early 70s would have turned somebody like you around before you even got to the place where you ended up doing 18 years of your life inside the prison system. I do believe that.
And I believe that some of the work that we do can also do that. You know, I mean, I've seen it happen.
And there are a lot of programs out there that have been successful.
We just don't put money into them. We don't care.
Not a priority.
This is the beginning, one of our Urbanite Radio stories. First of all, Laura Furr, Senior Director of Youth Justice Initiatives at Community Law and Action. Thank you for your work. Thank you for being here today, and congratulations on the baby coming.
Thanks very much.
Gary McElhinney is now lead negotiator with Schlockman, Belsky & Wiener, represents police in our community in legal issues. Former president of the Baltimore Fraternal Order of Police and former head of the Maryland State Transportation Police. Good to have you. It's good to see you again.
It's great to be back, Mark.
Mike Williams, good to have you twice in just a couple weeks in our studio. Playwright, youth advocate, man who wants to see a change, and we'll have you in here much more. Good to have you here. Thanks for your work.
All right, thank you.
Thank you all for being with us.
Thanks.
All right. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.